Welcome to the Other Half of Church podcast, a podcast at the intersection of brain science, theology, and church life. With Michael Hendricks and Jim Wilder, we explore the brain God has given us and what we need for a healthy, transformational community of faith. In the last episode, we talked about the role of joy in developing and nourishing and sustaining human life. And for the second ingredient of the soil, you talk about a very biblical term, one that I think many people may not have heard before, and it's chesed. And I think I pronounced that right with the good phlegm at the bottom there. Mm-hmm. What is chesed?
Well, in a part, it's really hard to define in English. There's more articles and books written on the whole subject. It's translated so many different ways that you can't even quite trace it through scripture, like God's enduring love. Sometimes it's called mercy. Sometimes it's called kindness. Whatever you call it, it's this ingredient that makes someone else intend and bring goodness or life into your life. So there's a committed, kind, helpful, loving, life-giving commitment on the part of the other person that goes throughout your entire lifespan. That's what it's meant in literature. So trying to figure out what's a good word in English. And as we began to look at it, we actually came around from the back side. So I started with brain science. And in brain science, the most powerful factor, the one that influences your building joy and the one that builds your character, is attachment. These are the people that your brain looks to for life. You know, it's the thing that makes little ducklings follow their mother. And began to imitate them, and things like imprinting, in other words, that we've talked about in science, that help you develop into whatever a larger version of who you are is. And it's also the thing that makes people attached to their children and their families and their marriages and all those very important relationships that form our identities and our group identity. Is called attachment, and it's right in the center of the brain. There's this part that's mostly in the thalamus, but every time someone that you care about, you think about them or you see them, it becomes very active. It's your attachment center. It says, I want you. And the attachment center is extraordinarily specific, so that when you attach to someone as your mother, no one else will substitute. So, you know, my mother died now about 20 years ago, and there's many wonderful ladies in the world who are very motherly. And if you brought them all around and said, here's your mother, my brain would go, nope, lovely, wonderful lady, but that's not my mother. And the same thing with your children. You know, once you attach to a particular child, you can't substitute out another one and go, oh, you lost that one. Here's another one. Right. Your brain goes, nope, not going to allow that at all. Now, you can have many more than one attachments in your life, but no one will substitute one for another. And it even doesn't work if your child's hamster dies. You can't just bring in another hamster and go, hey, another little lovely little hamster. That's not my hamster. Very, very specific. And that is the force that develops our identity. Now, if it's the most powerful force in the human mind, in fact, our attachments mean more to us than life itself. Parents, because they're attached to a child, will run into a burning building with, you know, less than 1% chance of surviving that, because attachment is just that strong. So we begin to say, well, if it's that strong, could it be possible that God would not address the most powerful force in the brain throughout Scripture? What describes that ongoing strong attachment to give life and to be committed to someone across their lifespan in the Bible? And the word immediately popped to the top was chesed. It's that loving attachment, commitment, that just won't let you go. It's, you know, neither height nor depth nor anything on earth, anything ever created is going to be able to separate us from this attachment that God has for us. In the New Testament, there was no word for chesed in Greek language, so they, I think, adapted the word agape as the closest thing that the Greeks had to it. But it's, again, this, you know, agape was an extremely obscure Greek word, almost never used until the Christians came along, and they said, here's a word that we can adapt. And it took St. Paul the entire chapter of 13 of 1 Corinthians to help a Greek audience understand what he meant by this. I think his mind's thinking Hebrew, chesed. It took a whole chapter to translate. So if you want to kind of understand chesed, go read the 13th chapter of Corinthians, and he tries to unpack this word into the Greek audience, and now we're trying to do it from Hebrew to Greek to English.
So what happens in the brain when those attachments are strong?
Well, when the attachments are strong, they become strong by what we talked about last time, which was building joy. The more joyful interactions we have with somebody, the stronger our chesed attachment becomes. In fact, some very interesting things happen, even at a chemical level. If your attachments to human beings are real strong, you will be basically disinterested in cocaine, heroin. With rats, the ones that had strong attachments would, they'd walk away from cocaine. They wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't use it. They would do the same with heroin. Rats that were kept lonely would kill themselves on cocaine and heroin. The Vietnam vets that went, over to Vietnam almost, very high percentage, almost 100% of troops used some very strong heroin while they were over there. The ones that had strong attachments came back to the U.S., never touched the stuff again. The ones that had weak attachments couldn't get themselves off the drugs that they got on in Vietnam. So we have these, you know, it's what we desire most. And if people will produce that feeling for us, that feeling of being loved in return, you know, we'll give up our lives for those people.
But it sounds like if those strong attachments aren't there, our brain so desperately wants it, it will kill itself on replacements.
Yes, this is one of the interesting things, again, about brain science. You've got all these different researchers working in different departments, and they don't know what each other are doing. So we had, in the 1990s especially, we had a whole group doing drug research, and they're discovering, oh, so the thalamus and especially the basal ganglion have this pleasure center down there, and that's what drugs stimulate. That's also sugar and alcohol. Everything that is pleasurable, does this pleasure center. And so they were talking about the pleasure center of the brain and how that's what's central to drug addictions and all kinds of addictions like that. On the other side of the university, they're studying attachment and imprinting and bonding, and they're studying the same part of the brain is responsible. So this is the attachment center, and this is what responds with great joy every time we have the person we love, or even with animals, the being they love, the other animals that they're attached to. This is responding over here. And the two researchers were running parallel to each other, never realizing that the attachment center gets taken over by drugs when you don't have strong attachments. So the lower the joy is in your life, the less likely you're going to turn to people, and the more likely you're going to turn to something that is reliable, like your candy bar or your alcohol or some other, you know, substance that will give you that shot of artificial joy. Doesn't build like real joy does, but for the moment there you feel what it would be like to be loved, and so pretty soon whiskey or whatever it is starts to take the place of your mother, and you actually become attached to these things in the same way that you would be attached to your family. And then if you have to lose your whiskey, it feels like you've lost your mother, and it's you know, it's very unbearable, and that's why we have such trouble getting out of addictions.
Again, it feels like this kind of clicks into place so many things in the world that you see of why are some people prone to addiction, and why for some people it just feels like it doesn't affect them. And there, it sounds like there could be, there's a void of attachment that those things are filling. So
the joy of attachment. And in fact, talking with recovery programs, the biggest factor on whether someone's going to recover is the nature of the relationships they have. If they have joyful relationships that are stable over time, those are the ones that are going to make it most likely that you will be successful in your recovery programs long term. Now, how about church?
Yeah. So how have you worked to develop? Are there different programs or strategies for developing Chesed? And in particular, what would you say to the person who hears this and says, how can I develop Chesed but do it all by myself?
Well, to begin with, if you smile at yourself, a mirror flips the image around when you're looking at yourself in the mirror. Mm-hmm. So to build joy, the joy starts out on the right side of your brain, goes to the left side of your face, and as you're looking at, someone is looking at you, the left side of your face registers on the left side of the retinas of each of their eyes, which is then sent to the right side of their brain. That's the joy pathway, right hemisphere to right hemisphere. And if they respond with joy, it goes from the right side of the brain, left side of their face, left side of the retinas of your eyes, right side of their brain. The entire cycle to them and back takes a sixth of a second. And when you see their joy, you put a little bit more on the left side of your face, and that's how it works. If you try to smile at yourself in the mirror, the left side of your face is reflected back, and it goes to the right side of the retinas of your eyes and goes to your left brain. So instead of getting a round circuit, it goes, my right hemisphere just got sent back to my left hemisphere instead of right hemisphere to right hemisphere. So smiling at yourself in a mirror won't do it. It's impossible to do by yourself. Now, it is possible to get a few animals that might like you. For instance, dogs like golden retrievers will reflect joy. They'll amplify joy with people. There's a few animals that will do that sort of thing. Don't try it with your cat too much.
Yeah, that may go in the wrong direction.
That could be. We do have attachments with animals that help us a little bit. So, but in church, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. We haven't developed church where joy is a value. So we don't know how to develop joy. And we have, in every culture that I have studied so far, and I've been five continents and a lot of places around the world, there are more prohibitions about joy and who you can have joy with than there are about sex. Because you can have sex with lots of people and form no attachments. But if you build joy with somebody, you have a very strong influence on where they're going to be. In fact, one of my sad things is I do a lot of sort of postmortems on pastors that have fallen in some way, had affairs or, you know, that kind of thing. Inevitably, we find that their joy levels got low, and someone came along that created joy for them. And as one pastor who had actually oversight of almost 40,000 other pastors ran off with someone, said to me, "I had more joy from her than from my entire ministry." Now, he didn't even know the brain science, but we keep noticing that if you get people smiling at each other and forming joy, it breaks up marriages. It causes all kinds of troubles in churches. So churches tend to prohibit joy rather than build joy. And what we need to do is begin to have a safe environment in which we build joy as a group, not kind of one-on-one. One-on-one joy over age 13 almost always turns into couple joy. But three together building joy turns into family joy. And in family joy, you want to bring more and more people into it. So, you know, really, if we can't solve the problem of how to have a group identity where we're joyful together in a church, we really can't overcome the problem of how we build joy safely unless we just have parents build joy with each other and with their children. And so to start with, I always say, who are the people that God has put in your life? And how do you go about building a few more minutes of joy with each of them by smiling at them and noticing who they are and enjoying that each day? And so if we start with the people God's put in our lives and build joy there, we will discover that we're happier to be together. You know, the level of resilience grows. So every night before bed, my wife and I do three things. We tell each other three things we appreciate about each other from the day. And that book gets a smile every time I tell her three things I have appreciated about her today. Yeah. We also tell each other three things we've appreciated about God today. And, you know, there's actually a nice book published by Moody Press, I think it is, on the habits of a joy-filled marriage with Marcus Warner and Chris Coursey. That has, you know, a series of exercises you can do to actually build this kind of joy with each other on a daily basis. And you know, that builds resilience into your family and marriage.
In this episode, Jim Wilder explained how his exploration of brain science led him to discover the importance of the Hebrew word chesed. Chesed is a secure attachment that develops in infancy through joy. Addictions are pseudo-joys and develop when this chesed is lacking. In the next section, I will discuss with Michael Hendricks how the church can demonstrate and develop chesed among its people. Michael, from my conversation with Jim, chesed is a strong and loyal attachment that's processed in our brain, but it can be an attachment to God and to others. But it feels to me like materialism and consumerism, which are just ubiquitous in our culture, they're kind of like anti-chesed forces in our lives. How do you see those forces interacting within the church?
Well, a lot of things like consumerism. I think Jim talked in the previous episode about pseudo joys, you know, something that gives us a sense of meaning and purpose, but not outside of relationships. And so a lot of times in churches, we can do the same thing. We think our success is defined by certain numerical things, certain things that we accomplish, and then which those things in and of themselves aren't bad. But when they aren't accompanied by high levels of joy and this deep, lasting attachment, like a family type relationships, then it tends to fall empty.
How does the church reshape people's lives into something that finds joy instead of looking for it in the world?
Well, we learn, this is one of the things that's fascinating me when I first started talking to Jim Wilder, but that we learn a new pattern of living and a new way of values much more by seeing other more mature Christian men and Christian women living and doing mm-hmm. things and reacting to life much more than we do being told to do it. Although being told is a necessary part of that. So one of the key ways to increase joy and increase the levels of this hesed attachment is to see more mature people interacting with that and seeing how beautiful it is and mm-hmm. wanting that. And even just the image in our brains, just to see another person act with this, what it looks like to act with a high joy, high hesed life, that in itself will start to do some rewiring in a sense of what kind of things we value and how we look at life and what examples our brain pulls on as far as how we act like ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And now how do you create an environment where people can see that in the church?
Well, you know, it has to be intentional from the leadership, you know, first of all, and it has to be modeled to the people. But one of the key characteristics is a high hesed in community tends to be a community where we can openly and safely share our weakness.
Hmm.
So as long as you feel you kind of have to put on the happy face or you have to just share all of your successes, but you hide your weaknesses, that's a pretty strong sign that there's a weakness in the hesed of your community.
Hmm.
So, you know, that takes courageous leadership. That takes people who are willing to train us how to do it. What's it look like for me to share weakness openly? And also, what does it look like when someone else shares weakness and I accept them with kindness and safety in a way that they would want to do that again? They want to continue being open.
And I imagine that you have certain pathways to respond to those things. Just like I imagine sharing your weakness can go poorly really uh-huh. quickly. Yeah. It can turn into either you get attacked for your weakness or your weakness just gets told that it's not that big of a deal and you're doing just fine. So how do you thread that needle in a group of accepting weakness without accepting it?
Well, that needs to be trained and it needs to be modeled. You know, there's a third option for how shared weakness can be handled in an unsafe way, and that's fixing. Hmm. Like if I share something in that's a weakness or a failure of mine, and you immediately have a 3-point outline or a scripture that you quote to me.
A sermon.
And that exactly. And that will make me not want to share with you ever again about those things.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's such a knee-jerk reaction, I think, for so much of us. I think it's stereotypically in men, but I'm sure it's in women as well, where it's like you hear a problem and you want to fix it. And you, right. particularly if you see it in somebody else's life, and you're like, oh, if you'll just do this, your problem will be changed. What other option do you have besides fixing it?
So we just had this discussion in our home group because, you know, we're having to do it over Zoom right now. Hopefully mm-hmm. we'll be together here pretty soon, but
yeah,
I'd say over the last 2 months, 3 months, when people have shared weakness, there are a couple people ready with a solution.
Yeah.
And so just the last time we met, I started off saying, hey, before we get into the book we're studying, I would like to have a family talk.
Yeah.
And I said, we've committed ourselves in this group to keep the hesed very high between us. And what that means is we openly share our weakness and receive tender responses from the people in the group. Mm-hmm. And they said, but I've noticed in the last few months that people have been offering, without being asked, solutions, advice, et cetera. And, mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say, I would like to propose something. And I said, we can talk about what, you know, you can feel free to give me your advice, but I would propose that we don't ever offer anyone advice ever, unless they ask for it. And if there's a particular unique situation where you almost maybe feel God's kind of nudging you to say something, and before offering that solution, say, just ask the person, are you looking for any input on this? or do you just want me to sit with you in this and just be with you in it? And let them have the say if they're in the zone where they want to receive some input or get some advice, or if they just want to share their pain and have you love them in it and sit in it, both of which are very important. So, but we let the person choose. And so that's an example of having an intentionality around chesed and around sharing weakness. And that needs to be, honestly, it needs to be built through trial and error. You know, the couple months of fixing people was not actually a blessing in disguise because it led to this discussion and people accepted it and reacted to it very positively and started coming up with things. Okay, here's how we handle it. And here's how we remind each other in a way that's not shaming, but that'll keep us from giving advice. And so people really got into it and they were very thankful that I'd initiated that.
Yeah, because it seems like if we don't have that willingness to be vulnerable and weak, we end up presenting a facade of who we are. And so then we start to believe this lie that nobody will love me or accept me for who I really am. And so you really need that space where you can be open and honest and weak without being shamed for it and without being without turning into a vulnerability that can be exploited.
Right. And again, that's just the key to having good leadership that models that first. They're the ones who offer the weakness. And if it's treated with some fixing or some condemnation, the mature leader doesn't fall apart emotionally. Instead says, here, this is a good training opportunity. Let me show you what we're doing here in building Hesed and why we don't correct. And so, you know, it required, a lot of people have never seen this before. I'd never seen it in the family I grew up with. I'd never seen this before.
Right.
And so it's not to shame people when they try to fix, because a lot of times when they're fixing, it's, you know, there's good motives there. Sometimes they want to help you. Other times it's actually fear. They're trying to fix themselves. You know, they're nervous about what you just shared. So they want to calm their own pain by offering you a solution. But either way, there's really good, you know, corrections and learnings that come from that. And so, but it requires a couple people at least that are more mature, that have the capacity and the emotional resilience to stay teachable in those situations rather than break. You know, usually what happens when that happens is the group breaks up and people just start going and they go find another group.
Yeah.
And then Hesed is lost.
And that breakdown of community can just have such a tragic effect downstream. Just today I was reading about a Christian musician from my childhood who renounced his faith publicly. And he talked about how he didn't enjoy church or praying or reading the Bible. And that language caught my attention from the conversations that we've had, that he didn't enjoy basically the things that come with being a Christian, the fellowship, the prayer, the study. And it just made me wonder, when joy is lacking, how does that affect Hesed? Can you have that strong attachment to the church without joy being present?
No, you cannot. Joy and Hesed are really kind of in a circle of mutual growing. So Hesed makes joy grow, and growing joy builds deepens our Hesed attachment to each other. Mm-hmm. So at its foundation, this is like the foundation of any kind of discipleship or growth. There needs to be a very firm foundation of building joy and Hesed, and like a mutual loop of, you know, when I build joy with you, our Hesed is also deepening. And when I share weakness with you and you treat it tenderly, our joy builds. And that's the first thing we do before we get in to other stuff. And, you know, just the way the brain works, it gets the brain into a state when we have high, strong Hesed, high joy. Our brain is really set up well then to receive other practices like reading scripture or going to church in a way that's highly relational, sensing God's presence and being open to hearing his imprints on it and the Holy Spirit's workings in our life. Without joy, it can very easily become sort of an empty exercise where it's void of its relational content. And when it's void of the relational content, it's not working as designed.
Yeah, and it seems like sometimes that it's the practice that is encouraged. And I don't really hear much about that practice combined with the community and the joy that's supposed to go with it to make it fruitful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in our book, we talk about, you know, rebuilding the relational soil of your Christian community, and the first two, and there's four ingredients to that, and the first two ingredients are joy and hesed. Mm-hmm. And that is the place you start, because if it isn't ultimately grounded in relationship, then it's, from then on out, it's not going to work very well. And it's going to tend towards this kind of legalistic or fixing or things like that, which, you know, they don't feel right. And they also don't get our brain in a zone where our character is going to be transformed.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jim had given one caution in particular as we're trying to develop hesed. He had mentioned that one-on-one hesed, one-on-one joy typically turns into couple joy, and that can often lead to issues. So how do we build hesed in a church environment that is safe and that's going to lead to a healthy community and not have the dangers of causing trouble like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. The one of the keys is, first of all, to have, and I keep coming back to the same point, but having kind of mature, what I would call mature eldership in the community. And these are people who are well-developed around joy and hesed and other areas as well. And they can lead the community at the right pace, at the pace that they're able to go. They will also be able to spot and do all exercises, you know, in maybe groups of three or four rather than twos. The exception to that is if you build joy with like a family member or your wife or husband and things like that, it's actually very, very satisfying and it's healthy for your marriage. And my wife and I do this all the time. But in a community, in a church, we should be a little more careful and do it in threes or things in small groups that spread it around and don't make it a one-on-one relationship, which could cause all sorts of problems, because basically that's the way God designed our brains, is to react to these kind of facial cues one-on-one, you know, with a deep, deep bonding. But we need to be careful around that too.
You've been listening to the Other Half of Church podcast, a podcast at the intersection of brain science, theology, and church life. To learn more about the book by Jim Wilder and Michael Hendricks, visit theotherhalfofchurch.com.